Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hi, my name is Grigor Dimitrov, and you're listening to Tennis Podcast.
Hi, I'm Mats Wilander, and you are listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. My name is David Law. I'm a tennis broadcaster for BT Sport and BBC Radio 5 Live, joined by Catherine Whittaker, also a tennis broadcaster, and we convene as the clay court season really starts to get going now, Catherine, because Madrid is upon us. This is a tournament that a few years ago was played on blue clay. Blue clay. Those were the days. Oh, I wish we could have blue clay back. Before we get on to that, I should also add that we have a very special guest on this edition of the Tennis Podcast. It is Paul Hutchins, the man that was the captain of the Great Britain Davis Cup team for 12 years in the 70s and 80s and was the last man to help Britain to the Davis Cup final. He will be our special guest here on the show. We'll be speaking to him soon. But first of all, Catherine Whittaker. Blue clay, discuss.
Well, I liked it aesthetically. The point you've made in many a previous podcast is you like things that are different in tennis, don't you? You're a wee bit of a contrarian. So it was undeniably sort of a bit exciting that it was different. However, something being sort of a bit exciting and a bit different at the expense of the integrity of the game.
In what way was it contradicting the integrity of the game?
Well, all I have to go on, I mean... I didn't play on it. I didn't experience it firsthand, but I can only trust those that did play on it firsthand who said that the quality of the clay wasn't great. You know, Rafa said that, Federer said that. I can only but take their word for it. And if you want to doubt their word, David, be my guest, but I trust their opinion.
Well, come here, Novak Djokovic and Rafa Nadal, and I'll talk you around. I'll get Roger Federer in the room, who was quite happy with blue clay. Thank you very much. Well, anyway, because of you lot, we've no longer got blue clay. We have to have this red stuff that we have every single other week of the year, apart from in Charleston when it's green clay. Hey, that's good, by the way, isn't it? I like green clay.
I like the green clay. I mean, I'm all for any colour of clay, so long as it's good quality clay.
What would be your favourite new colour of clay if you could choose any colour for the Catherine Whittaker Open?
Maybe some multicoloured clay, you know, different colour inside the lines to outside the lines. Maybe some white clay. Do you remember that Champions Tour event a few years back where they brought back white tennis balls? That was good, wasn't it?
It was good. Now, there's a question for you at Tennis Podcast. Do let us know the colour of clay that you would most like to see and why. Catherine Whittaker wants snow-coloured clay. The mind boggles. What colour ball would you have to have for that?
Like maybe a red ball, something like that. I don't know. This is all springing from my imagination. My mouth's writing checks that I can't cash.
Oh, my word. She's only gone and quoted Top Gun, a film from the mid-80s when Catherine Whittaker was not even alive. Now, on the Tennis Podcast, we have a big question for you as Madrid gets underway. We're talking about eras because I put out on Twitter recently that Novak Djokovic now has a lead in the rankings, which is the largest lead ever in the rankings since they began. Is it the most dominant in the era that we've ever seen? Is he more dominant now Well, somebody in the background here is really disagreeing with that assertion. There is a two-year-old who's wandering around at the moment who's heard me say that Novak Djokovic is the most dominant player in history and is letting me know that that is not the case. In her or his opinion, aged two. Catherine Whittaker, what do you think? Is it more dominant? And bear in mind, he's won the Australian Open. He's won Miami. He's won Indian Wells. He's won Monte Carlo. Where will it end? What's he going to win next? Could he win the calendar Grand Slam? And more to the point, how does Roger Federer era 2005 to 2007, Rafael Nadal in 2010 compare? What do you think?
Well, there's a couple of things to mention before I actually declare my opinion specifically on which year was the most dominant, which is that the ranking system changed. The points, the calculation of the points changed in 09, I think. So it's not a like-for-like comparison, the lead that Djokovic has this year compared to leads prior to 09.
Do tell.
I don't think it's possible to recalculate. If anybody out there wants to try and recalculate what the, if, adjust for inflation, if you like, what the ranking lead was for Federer in, let's say, 06 compared to what Djokovic is now, all I can say is it's not a direct like-for-like comparison. That is not to take away from Djokovic's utter dominance this year and the fact that he has done something nobody has done this year, which is to win the Australian Open and all three opening Masters Series titles of the year. In fact, take away the Australian Open, nobody's won those first three Masters titles of the year. And he's favourite for all the Masters titles going ahead. And for he's favourite for everything at the moment. So who knows where it could end. However, for me, Federer in 06 was in a different league. It was a huge deal if he dropped a set in 06. For me, if you recall, I haven't always been a Federer fan. I am now. I'm making up for it now by being...
Why weren't you a Federer fan?
Because he was too good. He was... like Superman without kryptonite. He was not human. It was inconceivable that he could lose a match or even look like at any point he might be vulnerable to losing a match.
What have you got against perfection?
I couldn't relate to it. He was inhuman. I feel ridiculous about it now because I'm such a Federer fan and I know once Federer is gone and the time is nearing us, whenever it will be, he's not going to be around forever, I will so deeply regret all those years when I was unable to relate to him and unable to support him. But I just felt like, you don't need my support, Roger. You're just too good. You are the best I have ever seen. And as sensational as and dominant as Djokovic has been so far this year, for me, it doesn't compare. I mean, I watched Djokovic lose to Karlovic, for example, in Doha earlier this year. Yes, it was the beginning of the season. However, he did show a bit of vulnerability that I could see in the same circumstances, given the exact same circumstances next week, say, I still think he could lose to Karlovic. It was horribly windy. Karlovic is a horrible player to play against. And he was irritated and not playing his best, and he lost. And I could see that happening again next week. Yes, those are a very specific set of circumstances. But the fact that I think that that's a possibility, a remote possibility. For me, Federer in 06 losing, unless something was seriously wrong, just wasn't even a remote possibility, unless it was to Rafa.
Side note... Do you know, there's a lot of blokes listening to this right now who are thinking, this really irritates me. People only become a fan of you when you've got vulnerability, when there's things wrong with you, when you're doing things wrong. You know, blokes go around the world trying to be good human beings. Girls don't even look at them. And then as soon as they become bad and start doing things wrong and losing all their money in the casino, suddenly they become interesting.
Well, hang on, Federer's not losing all his money in a casino, as far as I know, and he's certainly not bad. Well, I appreciated him to the nth degree back then. I thought he was the greatest. I thought he was a great man off the court and on the court. I just couldn't support him because he was too untouchable. He was too impervious to any circumstances, any surroundings. I can't relate to that. I'm impervious to everything.
I'll vouch for that.
And I just, as incredible as Djokovic is this year, I don't see him in that light.
But could you?
I mean, if he wins everything between now and November, of course I could.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest, the numbers are pretty compelling when you actually look at these two players' eras. Roger Federer in 2005, 81 wins, 4 losses. 2006, 92 wins, 5 losses. 2007, 68 wins, 9 losses. And he was winning 3 Grand Slam tournaments a year. I know what you're getting at with that. Well, certainly 2 in 2005, because he obviously lost the semi-final to Marat Safin. However, Catherine, let's look at a couple of other players here. Rafael Nadal in 2008 went 82-11. He also won the Olympics, and he beat Federer, the mighty Federer, on that Wimbledon centre court. What an extraordinary win that was. What about 2010, when he completed the career Grand Slam, won 3 Grand Slam titles in a year himself, and went 71-10? And don't forget, this guy just kills Federer.
He does, but what we're... I mean, and he was sensational in those years. However, what you're describing, what we're debating here is dominance, utter dominance. In those two standout years from Nadal, one he lost 10 matches, one he lost 11, which is obviously an incredible record. We're debating the minutiae of greatness. However, 10 and 11 matches is different to losing 4 and 5, isn't it? I mean, he was slightly more beatable. He had slightly more off days. I mean, how many of those 4 and 5 losses that I mean the one, the semi-final you mentioned, he had match points in that match against Safin. I mean, do you remember what Safin had to do to beat Federer in that? I mean, that's what it required to beat Roger Federer. I mean, every time Roger Federer was beaten in those 2 years or 3 years, it required something utterly superhuman. Now, looking back to, I know it was one-off defeat to, I mean, Djokovic also lost in the Dubai final this year to Federer, and neither of those, I don't think, were superhuman efforts in order to beat Djokovic. And let's look back to the Monte Carlo final. Djokovic wasn't great that day. And yes, he didn't win, but had he been up against somebody whose game he matches up slightly less well against than Berdych, he could have lost that day.
Yeah, but hold on a minute. What about Federer, the fact that in 2005, 6 and 7, he didn't have to play Novak Djokovic?
Yeah, but he had to play plenty of people that were pretty darn good.
No, they weren't, though. They were good. Sorry, Leighton Hewitt, Andy Roddick, Marat Safin, and everybody else in the whole world. You were good. But you weren't... No, wait a minute. You weren't dominating an era that Djokovic is dominating at the moment, in which he's having to play two of the... arguably the two greatest players of all time. He's dominating in that era, Novak Djokovic, at the moment.
Well, hang on, look. I mean, I would say it's all relative. Federer made everybody else not look as good. He just made people look rubbish.
Are you saying that he would have made Djokovic and Nadal look rubbish?
No, I don't think you're comparing like for like. He wouldn't have made Djokovic and Nadal look rubbish, but, I mean... if it was Djokovic now against Federer 06, Federer would be number one.
Yeah, but he wouldn't be dominating, would he? And I don't even know if he would be number one. That's a good question, isn't it? If we had all those three in their dominant era form at the same time, what's going to happen?
People hate this question, don't they? Every time I ask... you know, one of our champions talk guy, who's the greatest? You know, can you compare? Let's imagine that John McEnroe and Rod Laver and Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras were all in the same era. Who would win? You can see their eyes roll and they just go, "Duh, don't." You can't possibly compare. You know, all the platitudes. You know, different racket technologies. Different.
Yeah, but these guys use the same rackets, don't they? That's why we're sticking with this last 10 years. You've got three of the greatest players of all time that have all had dominating periods in, and we're trying to say whose was the most dominant. I would say, now you've made the case for Federer there, the counter argument is that Djokovic has gone 70 wins and 6 defeats in 2011, and most of those defeats were at the end of the year when he basically run out of gas because he won the first 42 matches of the year. In 2012, he went 75 wins, 12 defeats, 74-9 in 2013, 61-8 in 2014. He's been incredibly consistent, Djokovic.
Yeah, but we're talking about a season of dominance. We're not talking about consistency, and none of those stats he just mentioned measure up to Federer in 06.
Yeah, but they must be weighted by the fact that he's had to beat Nadal and Federer in that era at the same time, whereas Roger Federer had Andy Roddick and Leighton Hewitt as his chief contemporaries.
And Nadal and Agassi.
He had Nadal in early years form when Nadal was more of a threat on clay, less on everything else.
But still a mighty threat. And Djokovic has got Federer aged 33, where he is undeniably slightly less of a threat. I mean, there's caveats to everything.
It's a good debate, isn't it? What do you lot think? Let us know at Tennis Podcast. In fact, you have been letting us know what you think, because Kelvin Gray says it's only April, but this is definitely the best quarter of the year I've seen from any player. One major, three Masters, still going. He also says Federer had a weaker era, which is the point I made, and he'd say that Nadal 2010 in context for the competition. I don't really get that last bit. Susie Reed says that Novak is amazing, but Federer 2005 to 2007 is unparalleled. Matt Roberts says what Djokovic is doing is remarkable, but Federer, I think, had a comparatively bigger lead in 2006. Ultimately, I can only go on my personal opinion. Much as I love arguing with you, I would say Federer in that period as well, just because I think the other things that that you have to add in. I mean, yes, he lost 9 matches in 2 years. It's absurd. Plus, I know it shouldn't come into it, but it's the way he did it. It's the style. It's the elegance. It's
the elan.
Yes, to use my word from last week, which I'm going to slot into general conversation from here on. But yes. And I think the other thing is that I think what would have happened if you did put them in the same era at that level, you'd just get a lot of a mixture. You'd get a lot of variety of winners. You wouldn't have domination from any of them, I don't think, because at their very best, Federer didn't have to play that high backhand that he has to play against Nadal all the time in the very early years on other surfaces. He didn't have somebody who could stand toe-to-toe with him and hit deep shots the way that Djokovic can. But I still think in that ping-pong-type match that those two have, I think Federer would have won marginally more.
As you know, I agree, David. I think I would go so far as to say possibly more than marginally. I think Djokovic would win some, but I think Federer would come out on top the majority of the time there. Federer in 06. I mean, Federer in 06 was just the best. I cannot imagine anything better tennis-wise than Federer in 06. I mean, obviously that would be proven wrong at some point. You know, there was a time in ice skating when people thought it was inconceivable that quadruples could be, they thought it was physically impossible that someone could perform 4 revolutions in the air and then land. Obviously, somebody at some point in the next 100 years will be better than Roger Federer. I just don't know what that will look like. It's so impossible. It's like trying to imagine a new colour. It's not possible. Okay, the new colour thing actually is impossible. But the Federer thing, I think, will happen. I've no idea what that will look like. Someone better than Roger Federer in 2006.
Don't listen to what we've got to say about it. Let's ask Paul Hutchins.
I think probably the most dominating is Roger. And I think that people associate Roger being the best player ever, which you can argue. And I think McEnroe argues that Nadal is the best player ever. But I think that people associate Roger, and I certainly would, with his style of play and his character and the way he has dominated the game from an image point of view. I mean, you only have to realise at the ATP finals, you know, he's won it, I think, the most popular player, 10 times running or something ridiculous. So I think Roger is the most dominant person. Borg, as we know, and Sampras has won Wimbledon, you know, numerous times. But I just think that Roger is always going to be known for many, many years, even more than the Djokovic era. I think he will be known as the person that has dominated tennis, not only from a tennis point of view, but from a style, from a character, and from a sort of a good guy image. So I really like that image of Roger being the dominant person, you know.
And if we were to go back two generations that you'll remember, that perhaps people listening to the podcast may not remember, but you were right in the centre of it, and you were part of a Davis Cup team and captaining a team that went all the way to the final, which we'll talk about a little bit later as well. But is part of your admiration for Federer the fact that he perhaps reminds you of players from that era, which, you know, people aren't necessarily like that today?
No, they're not. I mean, people in the era of the sort of the 60s, 70s, you know, you've got people like Rod Laver, Roy Emerson, people like that, and Bjorn Borg. We were very fortunate once in the Davis Cup to have Borg practicing with us when we played Monaco in Monte Carlo. It's sort of the, rather like Roger Federer, it's the modesty of these people that I've just mentioned that really, to me, is so great. You know, the Edberg era, the Willander era, the Swedes were like modest, good fun, always together, watched each other's matches. Rivalry, yes, but actually, you know, respect rivalry. And I think that, you know, you can be, from a coaching point of view, you know, coaches often say, come on, you've got to be more aggressive and you've got to be this and you've got to be that. But actually, the people I mentioned, you know, are very respectful of other people. And even people like Sampras and these, I mean, a lot of it, we've been very lucky. We perhaps had the Connors and Nastasi era of, and McEnroe era of more aggression, more, not hatred, but more, you know, where there are probably more tennis rules that were brought in those eras to counteract their attitude towards things and their behaviour with a small b, than anywhere, any time else. But whereas with the people I've mentioned, you know, you didn't need rule changes because they had a lot of respect for the game. And probably being the sort of person I am and the age I am, I relate to that sort of thing on behalf of the tennis public, really.
We've been discussing a lot over the last few weeks as well. It is the big talking point in men's tennis is Djokovic going to complete that career Grand Slam by winning the French Open this year? He's up against history in the form of Rafael Nadal, who's going for his 10th French Open this year, and he's only ever lost one match in a decade. He's only ever tasted defeat on that court once in his whole life. Where would you stand on it at the moment? Obviously, Djokovic has got the wins under his belt recently, but this is Rafael Nadal we're talking about.
Yes, I think he will, and I think he could, or shall I say, he could and he will, and I think he deserves it. It's also a question of a sort of personality. The personality of Borg and the personality of Sampras was, you know, pretty boring, really. But Djokovic hasn't yet been, he's not the sort of person that is sort of, he's respected by everybody, but people like Federer and Nadal have got that personality, and I'm sure that Djokovic wants to have that personality, and I don't know him, never met him, and he seems a really good guy, but I'm sure he would crave after the sort of the adulation those players have got versus Djokovic, and it will probably come over the next couple of years. The adulation and the respect will be even more for Djokovic. He is one of the best athletes in the world. He is like a rubber band, the way he moves around the court, and he has that desire to improve that Andy's got. And, you know, Andy and he, I think, have both got the sort of, they're the same age, they've been brought up with each other, and they've both got that, you know, desire level as the others would have. I remember speaking to Paul Anacone when he coached Roger Federer once, when he started, and I said to him, Paul, you know, what do you say to Roger Federer when you're day one of a coach? And what Paul was saying was that, well, Roger still wanted to know what he had to do to improve. And I think that that's so great, isn't it? And that's what Djokovic has got, and as well as Andy, and they just want to improve. And I'm really hopeful that Djokovic actually gets over this sort of slight adulation of Nadal and Federer, and gets into the general public's eye of being such a really great guy and a one with personality. I think he will do it.
And I suppose if he keeps racking up the number of Grand Slams at the rate he is at the moment. I mean, he's already won 8 of them. That's the same number that Agassi and Lendl won in their entire careers. It's just that Nadal's on 14 and Federer's on 17. But how many could this guy end up with?
I know. It's interesting. When golf, which is, a second sport of mine, there's so many winners of so many tournaments in golf, whereas in tennis over the last, 4 or 5 years, and there's quite a small number of people who have been winning the biggies, and in golf, so many different people win each week almost. I think he can go. I think that each era will go higher and higher, and I think that he's only 27. He'll probably go till he's 32, 33. He's, as I say, like a rubber band. He's a beautiful athlete, and he's so fit. And providing he's injury free. And I think the style of play that someone like Roger Federer is, the reason he's able to carry on so long is that his style of play is unlike Nadal, where every single shot of Nadal, it's actually, out of 10, it's 9 out of 10, 8, 9 out of 10. Whereas people like Federer, he's so smooth and technically so proficient that he would be sort of 6 or 7 out of 10 each shot he hits. And it wears on the body. And I think if Djokovic can stay fit and he certainly stay motivated, because he wants to pass, because once you've got all the money in the world, once you've got all the trophies in the world, what do you need? You need history. You need legacy. And I think that these guys, when they get this big, they're fighting for legacy.
They sure are. Now, all of these players have tasted glory now in the Davis Cup, the ones you mentioned. The one that hasn't so far at the very top level and actually won it is Andy Murray. But Great Britain are now into a quarterfinal. It's going to be played at the Queen's Club, which we now know about. What do you make of the way Leon Smith is running the British team, having been a captain yourself for 13 years and taken Britain all the way yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I know Leon very well. He is good at pulling the team spirit together. But one of the big things that Leon has got, which I had in my era, I captained 31 Davis Cup matches, and the majority of those, I had a brilliant number one, a guy, Buster Mottram, who some people would have still know. He was 18 in the world and a brilliant Davis Cup player. And one of the big things about captaincy is it doesn't matter how good you are, it's what's your team. And with a player like Andy Murray, you've got virtually, apart from, the very, 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 very top people, you've got two rubbers under your belt under normal circumstances. And you've potentially now in Britain got a great option on doubles. And we've had an option on doubles, thanks a lot to Louis Kea over the years. We've got some good doubles combinations. And therefore, from a team point of view, Leon is very fortunate in having that, but he's been able to pull those together. He's very good at analysis, Leon. He's very good at dotting all the, crossing the T's and dotting the I's on what the team spirit should be like. Good preparation. He knows the players. He's done a very good job with James Ward and others, who he's got into their head you know, what to do on the circuit. And he's good like that, Leon. And he's very enthusiastic about Davis Cup, as we all were and as we all are. And therefore, I think he's got a good chance. But it's all down often to the number one player as to whether or not he, you know, he pulls the business in. And we're everybody would think that Andy will, because he's such an amazing player.
And yet France is a particularly formidable side, isn't it? Because they've got so many players, so many options.
I think if we wanted to be, you know, I've been through a number of eras of chief executives and different things. And I think if there's one country that we would like to emulate, it's France. But interestingly, France would like to emulate us, because they haven't had a French Open champion since Yannick Noah, and they would like an Andy Murray. And when I speak to my friends over in France, they're very envious of us, and we're very, and I personally am very envious of France, because I love the club scene. I love the way they produce their top juniors and give them all opportunity. And I just like the depth of talent that they've got. And that's what we've been, you know, missing and would love to have. So France are going to be difficult. They've also got a good doubles team. And so often, you know, it's going to be based on the first day, whether we can get to one all. And if we can get to one all, then it's the doubles. And it's going to be nail-biting, the whole thing. But it'll be a very exciting tie. Can't wait.
Last pound, where's it going? Britain or France?
Oh, definitely Britain. I mean, even if I thought France, I would say France. But I really do think so. I think it will be, because I think that Andy can pull in two. And I think we've got a very good shot in the doubles. And I think James Ward, and we've got Kyle as well behind him. You know, they can do well. And particularly James has proved that he's now matured into a very good Davis Cup player. I just want James to, you know, get that sort of form on the circuit. And I think he can, if he can get that form on the circuit, then he can, you know, he can quickly reach 75 in the world, which is, and then after that, who knows?
Well, that will be music to the ears of the people that run the environment in which we sit at the moment, because Paul and I talk to you from the National Tennis Centre in Roehampton here in London at the moment. And don't worry, we're not under attack, although you may wonder whether we are because of the planes that are going overhead at the moment. Paul did warn me that it would get busy overhead at the moment, but that's absolutely fine here on the Tennis Podcast. We like to go with the elements. But Paul, in terms of looking back at the days that you were captain, I just wonder, when you first got given the job, what was that?
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Moment like for you?
I was quite young. I was 31 years of age. And in those days, we're talking about back in 1975. And in 1975, the LTA turned a huge corner because it was always sort of rather blazers, you know, blazers of councillors ran the selection committee and the discipline committee and the teams and the and had all the say. And what they did with myself, and I was very honoured to 31 years of age, to say, Paul, this is your bag now. Men's, women's, head of this, head of that, Davis Cup. I mean, all the teams, captain of the teams. We used to have a thing called the King's Cup as well, which is like the equivalent of the Davis Cup indoors during the winter. And they rather sort of passed all the sort of selection, discipline and everything over to me. And in those days, the All England Club, you know, the actual revenue from the All England Club was, you know, a couple of, a few tens of thousands of pounds. Because in those days, you know, the marketing of the All England Club hadn't come through and the commercial revenues hadn't come through. And we were very orientated towards very low budgets. And it was a very good time because we created in those days, and not only me, but, you know, we created a regional structure and a national structure. And it was great. It really was. And I stayed with the LTA until 1987. I had 13 very enjoyable years, 31 Davis Cup matches, tons of junior matches I captained, 18, 16, 14. And it was really good. Looking back, I don't know how we had the four children as well, and because I was so busy. But it was really good, and I thoroughly enjoyed my time at the LTA. And I'm probably one of the few people that sort of left the LTA under good circumstances and in 1987. And then I had 20 years gap from full time with the LTA. But my time at the LTA for 13 years was really good, and it really developed. And at the end of it, you know, we had a very, very large income from the All England Club because of all the commercial expertise of the club and all the television and sponsorship and major events that we were starting to do. So, but it was a very enjoyable time, very enjoyable.
You mentioned the run that you had, the years that you had in the job. Now, in 1978, Great Britain reached the final, and it took six matches that year to get there, or five to get there, and then the final. It's a lot of matches. What do you remember about that run?
Yes, I mean, in those days, on 1978, we were way back in early in the draw. You know, I can't remember what it was called, but it was probably preliminary draw, preliminary rounds, and we went all the way through. The big match for us was Australia in the semi-finals. We played at Crystal Palace, and it was really, we played three or four or five matches before that, so we were all as a team very united. And it was very important because, again, still like I was talking about Leon Smith, you know, with doubles, we had a doubles pair. So we had Mark Cox and David Lloyd in a doubles situation. We had many of the matches, not them all, but many of the matches, we had Buster Mottram, John Lloyd. And so we had all four people playing, and the Australia one was a big one because they had the Wimbledon doubles finalists, Masters and Case, and they had Tony Roach and John Alexander and people like that. And they were really good. And beating Australia was rather like, you know, cricket in Test match. You want to stuff these Australians. And we stuffed them. And it was fantastic. We had this match at the Crystal Palace. We laid our Supreme Court down at Crystal Palace on the wood boards. And we really did. And that was huge publicity for the game because it was the first time in 63 years that we'd got to the final. So it was very exciting. And then we got to the final against America and we played at Mission Hills. And that was McEnroe's first match. So I remember being in the tunnel with McEnroe, you know, walking on. It was his first match in Davis Cup. And who was this little squirt of a guy, you know, 18 years of age playing his first Davis Cup? And, well, he turned out to be quite a guy, didn't he? But anyway, it was very good, and we were actually 1-1 after the first match. McEnroe beat John Lloyd, and then Buster Mottram beat Brian Gottfried, and then we lost the doubles and we lost the match. But it was fantastic that, you know, we could get to the final, and you know, it took it took a long time to sort of replicate that. And we got to the semi-final once, and we did. We had a pretty good record in those 13 years, I have to say. But it was, as I said, it was to do with more of the players than myself.
You mentioned McEnroe's first Davis Cup rubber. He'd never played before. Could you see then what this guy would go on to become? Let's bear in mind this is 1978. So this is 3 years before his first Wimbledon title. He reached the final, of course, in 1980 as well, and he reached the semis before that. But could you tell what this guy would become? And were there also any signs of the temperament that he would have?
The answer to your question is yes and yes. You knew that McEnroe was going to be terrific. You know, he was such a sort of a, you know, it was such a good player at that age. I remember we played Czechoslovakia and Lendl was thrown in his first match at Eastbourne on grass when we played Czechoslovakia, and we whipped those the Czechoslovakia quite easily. And Lendl was 18 years of age, skinny little guy. But you could tell then that Lendl was going to be great, you know, not how great and not how good McEnroe was going to be. But, you know, we're sort of experts in our field. We like to feel, or I do. And I feel that, you know, at 16, you can tell whether or not the guy is going to be, you know, you don't know how many Grand Slams or how many tournaments you're going to win, but you can tell the class difference. And with McEnroe first match and Lendl first match, which I also experienced, you could tell that they were going to be exceptional players, yes. But McEnroe was, and he was just awkward, he was cussy, he was moaning and groaning, but he was great, you know. His talent, his eye-hand coordination, his talent for actually, you know, his sort of guile of the way he played, and his unnerving that it was a Davis Cup final, because, you know, Davis Cup finals is a big event, and we played in Palm Springs, Mission Hills Country Club, and you know, it was a great occasion for us, and we had a lot of support. We started the British Tennis Supporters Club there, and we had a lot of people flying over, and it was a really great occasion. And you know, we had a lovely year that year, and we won, as you say, it was seven matches, and so we sort of started with Monaco and Borg practicing with us, and ended with the final. So it was fantastic.
Now, you mentioned part of your team as well was John Lloyd and David Lloyd, a famous brother pairing, and they had doubles matches together themselves. You couldn't get two more different characters, could you?
You certainly couldn't. No, we had our ups and downs with David particularly. You know, David was a great motivated person, and an average player, but brilliant on a given day. He had a great forehand volley, first serve. I mean, he was really athleticism, you know, and a doubles player, pure doubles player. And he was a great sort of team player. He was awkward, and he was very cussy on things like this, off court, and you know, we all know what David's achieved, which is fantastic from a business career point of view. But he was great, and he and Mark Cox, who were the complete opposite, you know. I mean, Mark, you know, Cambridge University and left-handed and very, very straight and very, very... And yet David was this sort of hustle-bustle of a bouncy ball, you know, but they used to play well. John Lloyd, very funny guy, very amusing. He and Buster Mottram were probably the two most, you know, amusing people I've ever met together. Got up to all sorts of tricks without me knowing, I'm sure. And John was just a great guy, and I'm still very close to John, and it's nice. I'm not close to David, you know, but I'm very close to John. And, you know, he's just a good guy. And he was a bit of a pin-up boy in those days. You know, he had sort of... you know, in those days, you're talking about, you know, pretty short shorts, pretty brown legs, and all the girls used to go, oh, yeah. And it was fantastic that John, we can look back at John's sort of social, he was the equivalent of a sort of a gossip, you know, gossip columnist now. And, you know, he married, unfortunately didn't work out with Chrissy, and therefore he was the sort of the big social guy that the sort of the Daily Mail gossip columns always used to go to. And he used to be great fun, John, and a good player, very good player, and won some really good matches. When we beat Paris, we beat France in outside on clay, you know, I mean, on the centre court in Paris. I mean, those sort of matches you can remember. I mean, match point against Spain on clay. You know, we had some really good matches, you know, and John played exceptionally well, and David as well. It was great.
You mentioned that you're only as good as your team in many ways as Davis Cup captain, but when you're dealing with those sort of different kinds of personalities that you've mentioned David and John were, and I'm sure others as well that you would have dealt with, and being on the opposite side to a McEnroe, how did you see your role? Do you adjust it depending on who you're dealing with?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, moving way forward in 2012, I was the... Oh, in 2010, I was the team captain of the Commonwealth Games for England. And in 2012, I was the team leader of the Olympics. And that was brought us into Andy Murray, you know. I think you sort of manage a team, and it very much depends on the individuals. When I did my 13 years of captaincy, I knew the players very well. I made sure that I knew the players, and you've got to know the number one extremely well, because the number one is the one that you have to rely on. So I knew Buster very well indeed. I was an absolute opposite character to Buster, but I got to know the team very well. And we had other people, you know, Richard Lewis, who was the chief executive of the All England Club. I mean, he was on the team, John Fever, and other people were on it. And I used to know them very well. So I think the first thing to answer your question, the captain's got to know the player. Because, you know, it's no use you sitting on court with a player and telling that player something what he should be doing, that not working, that tactic, and then him looking at you saying, you are an idiot, you know, why do you do? You can't have that. You've got to have a try and build up a respect, a rapport, that at crucial times in a match you are the only person talking to that person on court. And it's very important, you know, to how you communicate your tactics and your views to that. And every player is different. And I remember when Arthur Ashe used to captain the American team, he didn't used to say anything. And he wasn't close to people. And I think that the good thing about Leon, particularly with Andy, is that he can speak to Andy. And if Andy's just lost, you know, a set, and Leon's perhaps told him something that didn't work, that Andy doesn't sort of blame him. And I think the rapport that you've got as Davis Cup captain is probably the most vital. Because if you slump, which we did, we had some pretty bad results, then, you know, it's not a sort of a blame game. And in Britain, there's too much blaming about, you know, the LTA's fault, it's that person's fault, you know, I didn't get any funding and I didn't get this. There's too much of a blame game goes on. And I think as captain, you've got to sort of avoid that and then try and get some good team spirit. But we didn't always have good team spirit. And it's based on the win, not the team spirit. You know, team spirit comes with winning. You don't often get good team spirit when you lose.
And your son Ross has obviously had a successful career as well as a doubles player. I just wonder, when he declared his interest in following in your footsteps, becoming a player himself, was that an easy decision for you? Is there anything that, as somebody who's been very involved in tennis, that is there ever any question marks in your mind as to, actually, I'm not sure I would want you to do that? Or is it always been the case that, well, actually, this is a great sport, you should do it?
Yeah, we've got four children, and all four of them were quite good, you know, either junior national standard and some of them international standard. So it was sort of a slow burn, I think, with all the four children, and they're all quite close in age, and therefore they all grew up in that environment. We were very fortunate that they went to school in Wimbledon, and we had the All England Club, who were fantastic, you know, on the courts, and we used to train there all the time, and therefore it was a sort of a slow burn. And Ross was always the persistent one out of them all. He was the one that would come back from injury. He was the one that would overcome, you know, all the difficulties. And he was the one that was sort of 16, was sort of set on leaving school early, whereas the others all carried on and went to university and did their A-levels. So Ross was always sort of the persistent one and always had the ambition to play tennis on a full-time basis. So it was a sort of a evolutional thing, you know. It was a slow burn, and it was quite obvious at 16 that Ross was going to play full-time tennis. So, and that was his desire, and therefore we as parents just supported him. So it was pretty obvious, really.
Now, Ross is somebody we've had on the tennis podcast. He's somebody I've got to know well, certainly involving the Aegon Championships at Queen's, where I'm the media director and Ross last year was tournament director. He came on, I remember, just over 2 years ago now, when he was just beginning his treatment for his Hodgkin's lymphoma, which he's happily went into remission from and is now retired from the sport, but came back successfully to the sport. That must have been quite a moment to see him overcome the illness and actually get back out on court the way he did.
Yes, I mean, I'm totally biased towards Ross, as you can imagine, as any parent would be, but he's a very impressive guy. He's very impressive, you know, on his persistence, on his career, with all the things that he's had, ups and downs in his career, with injuries and lots of illnesses and hospitalization and things. And then when he had the cancer, you know, he was also terribly impressive in that, you know, he wanted to have the chemotherapy. He wanted to have it, you know. It was something that he just wanted to get rid of. So he, you know, and all the doctors couldn't believe how sort of positive he was. And people talk about that, but the mental attitude of a cancer patient is probably the most important thing. And so a lot of people say to me, well, it must have been terrible for you, Paul and Shally. And it wasn't too bad, because we would have been sort of, you know, shivering and cautious and everything else if Ross had been. But he was very positive about it and wanted to get rid of it quickly. And we obviously supported it, and all his brothers and sisters and the family. So, you know, he just overcame these things, but that is typical Ross. And during his career, you know, he had a decent career, decided when he was about 17 to do doubles only, and he played Davis Cup several times, and, you know, and US Open and Wimbledon quarterfinal, etc., etc. And he's done really well. And now he's gone in as vice president of the player division of the ATP. You know, he's moved on into the next stage of his career, and that's what he does. He's an impressive guy.
Well, we wish him all the very best, and it's always great for us to see him on the tennis circuit and have him with us here on the podcast. Now, one of your other roles, Paul, these days is to be involved with the Nottingham tournament. You're the tournament director there. Tell us a little bit about what's going to be happening there this year, because things have moved on from last year, haven't they?
Yeah, the Aegon Open Nottingham is the last week before Wimbledon starts, so it's the qualifying week of Wimbledon. Around about 20th of June, and I'm the tournament director, and we also have a WTA up there as well, 2 weeks before, the first week after Paris. So we've really and I've been the relationship manager between the LTA and the City Council for quite a number of years now, and I also chair the Tennis Centre, which we have a 3-year agreement with the City Council, because Nottingham Tennis Centre is the biggest tennis centre in the country, 39 courts, biggest public facility. And we're determined to try to, you know, keep Nottingham as an event venue. And the Aegon Open Nottingham will be a very good event. And we're just at the process of putting the player field together. And on the 11th of May, we'll get all the players that will be signed up. We've signed up Feliciano Lopez, and we're just about to sign up a few other players. And I think it would be really good. And it's a thing that I have enjoyed doing. I probably just as soon and like doing the grassroots side of tennis as well. And in my career, I've done the performance side and the tournament side and the coaching side and the player, all sorts of sides, as you know, David. But the ATP is a good challenge. And, you know, I think the Nottingham City Council are right behind us, and I think it would be a very good event. So I'm hoping people will sign up. We're almost sold out on the finals day already. So, you know, we need to get your tickets in quickly, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. Get over to the Nottingham Open website and go on the LTA website. Find out where you can get your tickets for some great ATP and WTA action in the month of June. It's all going to be happening, and Paul will be residing over all of it. You mentioned the grassroots level there, Paul. Now, Weren't you out in India recently?
Yes, I wear various two hats in my business career. I wear an LTA hat, which has always been firmly on since 2007, since Roger Draper asked me to come back and head up men's tennis for 3 years. And I also am very involved in the road to Wimbledon. And the HSBC, who are the official bank of the championships, the HSBC Road to Wimbledon has been with us in the UK since 2002, which I've ran. And we've now, we the club, the brand name of the championships is so strong worldwide that the club wanted to maximise the brand, the Wimbledon brand, to Asia. And we decided to start this brand awareness in Asia, linked to Star Sports, our television, the television company that does all the Asian Wimbledon championships, and to expand the brand with the Road to Wimbledon. The Road to Wimbledon is very successful over here, and we also had HSBC to back us in India because they're very Asian orientated.
So, what is the Road to Wimbledon?
And the Road to Wimbledon is a 14-under tournament, and it involves 700 clubs in the UK. Under 14, and the finals are at Wimbledon in August every year since 2002. And the Indian side, we've gone over there and we do a series of Road to Wimbledons in India. We have a Masters, and the last two boys and two girls come over to our finals at Wimbledon. And we also link with Tim Henman as the ambassador of the HSBC ambassador. We took Goran over recently, Goran Ivanisevic, and he was great. Dan Bloxham, the head coach of the All England Club. And we do a series of tennis clinics, school clinics, children's clinics, went to iconic venues, and we do a lot of coach education over in India. And we basically spread the brand of the Wimbledon Championships and HSBC over in India. And we're also now going to looking at it and in Asia. I'm responsible for the logistics of all this on behalf of the All England Club. And we're now going to go into Asia and do a Road to Wimbledon circuit in Asia in 2016 and 2017. So it's exciting times and I'm very fortunate that at this stage of my career, I'm still, seem to have new inventive and creative things to keep me and other people occupied.
You've only just flown back in from Barcelona, haven't you? The life of the rider you've got.
I know, actually, yes. I was also in Miami recently on a holiday. In Miami, because Ross was over there working, and I went over there. Yeah, the Barcelona was just with the ATP tournament directors meeting. So I do quite a bit of travelling, but I'm very active still and very pumped up to achieve things for the LTA and pumped up to achieve things for the All England Club, and I love every minute of it.
It's pretty good, isn't it? Let's be honest. It's a tennis podcast. We're talking to people who love tennis. I get to sit there and talk about it all day. I mean, what's to complain about?
Absolutely, David. We're very lucky. I've been hugely, hugely fortunate.
Just to finish off, Paul, I'm lucky enough, as I mentioned, to be able to sit and watch tennis and talk about it in commentary boxes. I just wonder, in the years that you did the same, and I wonder of the people you shared commentary boxes with and so forth, and perhaps met personally, what was Dan Maskell like?
Dan Maskell, for the more older generation that's listening to this podcast, as opposed to the younger generation who may not have heard of him, he was Mr. Tennis. He was the national coach in the 60s, he was a gentleman, a great guy. He was one of the sort of the original gentlemen of the BBC broadcast. He had Wimbledon in his DNA. He had grass courts. He had the Wimbledon sort of the gut feel of how Wimbledon should be, and everybody used to quote Dan Maskell. And I, John Barrett, who was a great friend of mine, our best man, and probably someone who's guided me and mentored me, all his career. Dan and John were very close, and I used to do quite a lot of commentary with Dan Maskell and John Barrett and Mark Cox and people. I did it for about 10 years at BBC and all the other stations. And it was really great. And he was such a gentleman and had such an array of stories. And it was just a privilege to be a bit nerve-wracking. I'm not normally sort of a nervous poor guy at all, but it was a bit nerve-wracking because he was so dominant in the commentary box. And as you know, David, when you go into the commentary box with someone, it's a very close relationship. I mean, you're almost sitting on the guy's lap and you're sharing a microphone, and whatever he says, you've got to, you know, also link with. And you've got to be careful with Dan because he had been doing it for so long, and here was this like upstart whippersnapper Paul Hutchins coming in and pretending he knows all about it. And it was, but it was really good. And you know, it was a great occasion to have the experience with someone like Dan and with John. And you know, it was he's just such a great, nice man. You talk about Richie Beno and, you know, these sort of people like that. That's what Dan Musker was.
I asked John Inverdale not that long ago what Fred Perry was like, and also what he would have made of tennis today. And I wonder what Dan might have made of the current era.
I think Dan would have been very gentlemanly, very respectful. He would have loved Roger Federer. It's that sort of, you know, oh my word, his style, just look at that style, everybody. That's what he would be saying, you know. And he would be sort of oozing sort of enthusiasm for people with a lot of respect, you know, and that sort of thing. That's what Dan Musker would be like. And there are many commentators now, you know, Peter Alice, Richie Beno, you know, the late Richie Beno, people like that. That was sort of Dan Musker. And interesting, at our wedding, David, just a 30-second one, Connie, his wife, we arrived at the church and the organist had gone missing. So I said to the 40 or 50 people in the church, can anyone play the organ? And Connie, who must have been about 70 years of age then, piped up, yeah, I can play the organ. So I said, Connie, when did you last play the organ? 25 years ago, Paul. Anyway, Dan was sitting there looking at Connie as if, you know. Anyway, Connie played all the hymns and did a great job, and everyone applauded, and it was a great fun. And we went on honeymoon to Eastbourne and got Connie a sort of a little piano, and I always remember Dan and Connie being very, very appreciative of that. It was a nice moment for Dan. He was a super guy. Just lovely, lovely memories of that.
And finally, you mentioned you also knew Fred Perry, who comes up so much and perhaps a little less now that Andy Murray has finally won Wimbledon and taken that out of the equation for Britain waiting. But I kind of suspect, and I never had the chance to meet Fred Perry, but from the people I know who did meet him and did know him, I kind of feel that he would have liked Andy Murray.
Yes, a bit like larger than life, Fred Perry. I did a few works with him and the commentary and things. I mean, at worst, arrogant, but once you knew him, no. Very self-assured. Good-looking bloke, you know. You know, you can imagine when he was young. You know, he's sort of with his sort of long white trousers, and I mean, he's just a really nice guy, and nice family, and his daughter, and so yes, I mean, good memories of those. But that's quite a long time ago. You know, I mean, lots happened in my life and since then, and you know, we moved on a lot, and there's lots of new things happening, but people like Dan and Fred Perry and Rod Laver and other people, they would adapt to the current circumstances. You know, I really do believe that. And I think that, you know, they're in our memories and in my memories. But, you know, the modern era, I think, is fantastic. And we're very lucky to have the people we've got in the top of the game. And we're very lucky to have Andy Murray. I mean, Andy, who I know very well and has spent a lot of time with Ross and helped Ross enormously, you know, when he had his cancer scare. And Andy, we've got to be so grateful for Andy, you know, having, you know, replaced very quickly Tim Henman, who I deal with a lot on the road to Wimbledon. We're so lucky to have someone like Andy Murray, and we really should be thankful for that. And the LTA, we have got to be thankful for that, and the club.
Do you think he's got more Grand Slams than him, Andy Murray?
I think if you went into the dressing room and asked the top 20 players, has he got that question, I think 20 out of 20 would say yes. So that's good enough for me. And I think yes, I think that certainly he would have other Grand Slams because he's so motivated and he's so desiring to improve. He invests so much money of his own money. I know he's wealthy, I know he's rich, but he still invests so much of his money and his time and effort in his staff. And he's very faithful to many of his staff, and he just wants the best for himself, and therefore he doesn't shortchange anything of what he's got to do to achieve something. So he will have a great life thinking that whatever he's done, if he wins no more Grand Slams or wins another five, he would have done the absolute maximum for his life, which is wonderful.
And that's all you can ask. Absolutely. That's all you can ask. Well, it's been a pleasure for us to have you with us on the Tennis Podcast, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.